I can't believe I have to read this line, but I'm going to read this line because this is what they asked me to read. Earwolf, more like Fearwolf. Is this a Comedy Network or what? Get ready to quake in your headphones because Earwolf podcasts are getting extra spooky this October. You can listen to How Did This Get Made, The Canon, and Cracked Movie Club dissect spine-tingling horror classics all month long. And watch out for special spooktacular episodes. I cannot do the Paul F. Tompkins Dracula. I cannot. He only can do the Paul F. Tompkins Dracula. Spooktacular episodes of Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast, The Cracked Podcast, and Who Charted? Or should I say Boo Charted? That's the copy? Man, who runs this network? All right, follow along on social media with hashtag FearWolf so you don't miss any Halloween action. Now that the comedy is out of the way, on to serious business. Folks, esteemed listeners, a quick plug. We are growing here at Midroll. Podcast listening is up. We need to keep up with the demand. And in fact, we're also trying to grow the demand itself. So we're looking for the right talent to help us do that. That means we have job openings. From ad ops to back-end engineers, we also want some great marketing talent. Those of you out there who love podcasts and Google AdWords, whatever those are, those of you who love to evangelize about podcasts and get others on board, yes, you too. We want all of you in this big arc, this big, beautiful wooden arc we call podcasting. So go ahead, check out our job listings. They're at midroll.com/jobs. That's midroll.com/jobs. It's a big arc. Get on board. Welcome to the Wolf Den. This is the podcast about the business and the people of podcasting. I'm Chris Bannon. Lex Friedman, my co-host, is MIA. Just decided to be a no-show, but we'll find a way to get even with him for that. My guest is Allison Hockenberry. She is the chief of staff of Dubner Productions, the executive producer of our beloved Stitcher show, Tell Me Something I Don't Know. And she's also currently the executive producer of Freakonomics Radio. So we'll be talking for about 3 hours to cover your workload. Allison, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Before we interrogate you about your life and work, there's a segment we do, Lex and I. It's called Shows We're Jealous Of, although a friend says it should be actually envious, that I'm misusing the word jealous.
Yeah.
TBD. but the show I picked this week, and then I'll ask you for a choice, is Ear Hustle. Do you know that show?
I don't.
Radiotopia show, all recorded in the San Quentin prison.
Oh, I love that.
It's beautifully made. It feels very real. It feels like the dimension you don't get in stories about prison on television, especially, because it's multidimensional. It's not, people locked up and angry, and it doesn't try to give you a monochromatic view of the justice system or the people inside or the people who run it. It feels like an overheard conversation you wish you'd had a long time ago to try to understand what life there is like.
How do they execute it?
They record it in the prison, and some of it is recorded. It's not a maximum security facility, as I understand it from listening. So they are able to record on site, and then the tape is sent out to Curtis Fox, who edits it, a former WNYC colleague of mine, does it for Radiotopia. And then they pass it by someone in the chain of command, I think the communications officer at the prison, who then says, yes, this is allowed to go out.
Wow. Yeah. It's very documentary in style.
It is. Yeah. It's reminiscent of radio diaries a little bit,
sure.
but there is a host, and it's just very well executed, and I think an adventurous choice, and Radiotopia has been rewarded because it's done very well as a podcast.
Oh, that's great. I have to check it out. We have a dream of taking Tell Me Something I Don't Know to a prison or prisons.
That's a great idea.
Isn't it?
Oh, yeah. You really, someone who's listening now, one of the three of you should try to sponsor that show. Do you have a show that you are jealous of that you wish you were, was part of the Dubner Productions?
That's a good question. My answer is not something I think would be part of Dubner Productions because it's too big.
Mm-hmm.
But I really love Revisionist History. I think that's a great show. And I just appreciate the great writing. I like a very simple storytelling like that. In some ways, it's a little bit similar to Freakonomics Radio in style.
I was going to suggest that, yes.
So clearly, I have the things I gravitate toward. But yeah, I really like that show. I think the production value is great. I think he's got a terrific voice.
Yes.
I didn't really know that about him. And I think the scoring is lovely. I just think it's very simple, very well told.
Well, I will take, we can take a little credit on this side just because Laura Mayer, who made season one, works here at
Midroll. Works here now? I didn't
realize
that. She
does show development for us.
Oh, fantastic.
But she did
Lucky
a great
you.
Job on that
yeah, she
series,
did.
And
she
they
really
should
did.
Be very proud of it.
Yeah.
Slate, I think it was really good. He was also, though, speaking of strange coincidences, Malcolm was, I think, the guest on the pilot for Tell Me Something I Don't Know.
Indeed,
he was. In the
very
first one.
Yes, he was. He's actually been on twice. He was on the pilot.
Right.
And then we actually did a second sort of pilot to see if Stephen Dubner and I and a very small group of people could actually produce it ourselves. And we did it at a corporate event, believe it or not, just to test the waters. And he was there.
He was there. He's great. And I think we are all jealous of Revisionist History.
I think that's a terrific show. I'm sure my answer isn't terribly surprising. I'm sorry. But
you're fired.
I'm too busy to listen to as many podcasts as I'd like. So
that's the problem being in the industry. Well, let's turn the focus onto you and your life and your work and all the things. We've known each other for a long time now since you came to work with Stephen, I think, right?
Yep. Yeah. I think we'd met before that maybe.
Probably we have. And I'm curious, your background is in journalism. That
Correct.
Was what you started in television journalism. Can you tell people a little bit about the parts of your career that you think have sort of led you to this place in which you run a podcast empire?
Oh, a podcast
it
empire.
Is.
I
it's
like the way that
empire.
Sounds. Well, first of all, my journalism career started at my middle school newspaper, not in television. Just want
oh,
to
we're
let
going
you know.
Way back.
Always wanted to be a journalist.
Settle in, folks.
Okay, so how did I get here? That's an excellent question. I always loved print journalism and always thought I would go into print journalism. Ran my college paper. And then I didn't want to leave New York City. I went to college in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very hard to get a job in print straight out of college. You really needed to go to some small town and sort of work your way back to the city. I really wanted to stay in New York. And there was an opening for basically a coffee fetcher at ABC News at the network.
Was that the official job title?
It may have been. No, it was desk assistant.
Dan Rather, coffee fetcher.
Peter Jennings.
Yeah.
But yeah, close. So I worked at ABC News and I spent 10 years there. I worked my way up from fetching coffee and making copies and retrieving faxes, which we used to do in those days, to becoming a producer. And I really loved television news for a long time.
Was it difficult to make that ascent as a woman in that business?
Oh, good question. I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I think it was pretty fair. And I mean, there were issues that some people had, but I just never had any problems, you know, sort of getting ahead. I mean, I kind of kept my head down and did my work and then went home. But
like most people do.
Yeah. But I really did love, I loved that I got to be a generalist. I mm-hmm. loved that we had a lot of money to spend on making great stories. I was never that intrigued by the visual part of television news. It was fine to me, but I wasn't particularly great at it. I didn't mm-hmm. particularly care about it.
What role did you have in preparing the visuals or producing that part
well,
of it?
Well, my role was actually very similar to what it is when I'm podcast producer, in that I'm helping to come up with ideas, figuring out how to execute them, who should we interview, getting the interviews done, putting the puzzle pieces together to come up with a great narrative. And in television, you know, we had director of photography. We had a camera crew that we worked with. And it was very collaborative.
Mm-hmm.
And I tended to try very hard to find the best camera crews to work with so that I wouldn't have to think too much about that
stuff.
Oh,
that's interesting.
Yeah.
Some people would want to dominate that part,
very
right?
much so. I mean, most of my colleagues really loved that part. I just didn't. And I trusted the really excellent camera crews and let them do what they do. And of course, audio is a big part of television news too. So, you know, I learned a bit about that there.
Were there stories in your career that you feel now you can look back and say, oh, that was a thing that tilted me in the direction of where I am now?
No. I don't think there was
that's
a particular...
That's a dead end for me
start. I mean, I can't say there was a particular story mm-hmm. because, like I said, I was a generalist, so I covered war zones and I covered sports and I covered politics, you know, just sort of anything. But I think the one thing I did learn by having that breadth of experience was knowing that no matter what material you have, you have to make a great narrative out of it. I mean, this the sort of building those skills and those muscles to know how to, like I said, put the pieces of the puzzle together.
So for people who are listening who are trying to either pursue a career as a producer or are in the middle of it and trying to understand how to do a better job, what are there steps that you take when you say, oh, this is a thing I'm supposed to go report on? Where do you start building a story? And what are the things you look for?
Well, there's a number of ways you can do it. So it can be an issue that you really want to tackle, and then you have to find a way to make it interesting because issues in and of themselves
boring.
Aren't interesting, right? So you have to find people who can sort of make it come to life. Then sometimes it's about a person, and a person who's either in the news or done something kind of intriguing or spectacular. And then you have to find a way to make it a little fatter and put it into some context. So it really depends on, you know, your starting point can be various different things.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, is sort of part of working those muscles of like, okay, how do we turn this into a story?
Were you listening to audio news or long form audio or anything like that while you were busy making television, or was there just no time?
I think there was probably just no time. Mm-hmm. I don't recall it. I actually hated watching television, though, too. I never watched television.
The reluctant producer will be your autobiographical.
Yeah, I like that. I still gravitate towards print or whatever it's mm-hmm. called now, the written word. And I think that's why I like the podcasts that are written.
Yeah, they really rely, great ones, I think, on writing.
Yeah.
That feels like it has a voice the same way that you would find in a great newspaper writer
exactly. Or
in a novelist or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, exactly.
So how did you make that turn then into audio? Was it an accident?
Total
did someone
accident. No.
You answered an ad in a newspaper?
Not quite, but it's very much an accident in that. So when I left ABC News to have children, I took some time off. And then I knew I wanted to stay in journalism, but I didn't want to go back to television news. Television news was getting especially stupid by that point anyway.
Right. When was this, just to give us a sort of
99, late 90s, like 99.
Okay.
99, turn of the millennium.
Mm.
And it just became, whatever, it just became stupid. I don't need to explain to you how, because,
no,
you know, everybody knows.
I was there.
Yeah,
I saw it.
Yeah. But I did want to continue doing journalism. And so basically what I did was any time a former colleague or someone who had heard about me called me to see if I wanted to do a job, I just said yes. I said yes to everything.
That's actually a piece of great advice to anyone. Like, no job too small.
Yeah, and no job too unknown. I mean, I was asked to do two documentaries for the Lifetime channel. I'd never done a documentary before, but I just said yes. I mean, I figured I could figure it out.
Also lying.
Yeah. Well, I didn't lie. I just said yes. And
then
Nickelodeon News asked me to create the website to go with their Nick News Kids TV show. The internet was new.
Yeah.
And of course I said yes, and I had no idea I didn't even know really kind of what a website was.
Did you know how the web worked?
No, I had no idea, but I just said yes. I just knew I could figure it out. And they didn't want me to fail, so I knew they were going to give me some support to make it happen. So that was a fun job because I was the editor, writer, photo editor, and I did everything on that. So I wrote like 9 stories a week.
Do you think you were helped by being someone who didn't know anything in that instance?
Probably.
In what way?
In that there were no parameters to suggest that I was going to do something wrong. I mean, there was no wrong yet, you know? So I basically created it as I went. That was very fun.
And who is at that point, did they study the audience they were building this for? Did you know anything about the people you were making this website for?
I basically made it for our viewership of Nick News, which is a weekly show aimed at kids 8 to 12, I think, or 8 to 14. To be totally honest, I have no idea if anybody read. I mean, if you were a kid 8 to 14, would you go to a site about news? Probably not. No.
Plead the fifth.
Yeah. I tried to make it as engaging as possible for a young person, but I don't think they cared. I think it was a moment where everybody knew they had to have a presence on the web, but they mm-hmm. didn't know why or what they were trying to achieve.
I have a layoff from a similar time.
Oh, really?
I remember when that was, we must be there. What are we doing? We don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And after that, I actually went to a very similar, a startup. It was a website, Green Living website, where I was the editor of the home and living section or something. I don't know. And the venture capitalist, it was a company that wanted to, it was basically into green design and green engineering, like solar panels and stuff. And they felt that the market wasn't there yet. So they wanted to create a whole content sort of element to get the market there.
Really?
Yeah, it was a dumb idea, but really dumb idea.
But how many articles can you read about the efficiencies of solar panels?
Exactly. So that lasted a year, and that was one of those things where, you know, we had a meeting one morning and they said, oh, well, no, never mind, get out by the end of the week.
But, yeah. Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, that was too bad.
So is there any way in which that experience prepared you for what you do now?
Yes, very much so. It was, we were, you know, it was that sort of Silicon Valley fast iteration thing where you just like fail fast. What is it called? There's some weird
acronym. I
know
the fail part. The fast part I'm not clear on. But
it's sort of like fail fast to succeed or something. I don't know. Anyway, it was fine to experiment. Like we would experiment and if it sucked, we just got rid of it and we tried again. And I really liked that. I had never really done that before because I had been working in the confines of corporate media where there was a way to do things and you really couldn't experiment. Yeah. And so that was great. It was a really good experience. Also learning to translate, you know, engineering speak into English and back and forth, I think is a useful thing, just a useful tool in this day and age.
Yeah, I think we'll see how this plays out a little later in this conversation. We talk about the development and the continuing development of Tell Me Something I Don't Know. But we're not yet at your public radio landing point.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
So Stephen Dubner was looking for a new executive producer of Freakonomics Radio several years ago and asked my husband, who works at is a colleague at WNYC, if he knew of anybody. And he said, well, you should just talk to my wife. You know, she's finishing up a documentary. I had been doing a two-year documentary for the Discovery Channel. And, you know, she may have some ideas. So we met and we really hit it off.
Yeah.
And he needed a executive producer for Freakonomics Radio, but he also was getting to a point where he had more ideas he wanted to execute than he could without relinquishing total control of sort of new ideas. I mean, there's only so much one person can do.
Right.
And
many hosts never learn that lesson,
right,
by the way.
No, it's true. And he, you know, he basically said, I sort of need a second brain on things. But someone who adheres sort of closely to my sensibilities and my taste and that sort of thing. And I don't really know what this job is, but if you want to give it a try, let's just sort of create this kind of job. Let's call it chief of staff and and we'll see where it goes.
Was there a staff?
No, there was no staff.
Yeah.
So he also said to me, the one thing I don't want to do is start a production company. So 2 years later,
okay,
we have
so
a production company.
Yeah. Well, why didn't he want to start a production? Why not do it the way that has been proven to work in so many cases?
Because it's a pain in the neck to, you know, I mean, if you're a creative person like he is and you're a writer in, you know, in by profession and by sort of whatever sensibility, you don't want to be managing a staff and dealing with a budget and payroll and this, that, and the other thing. You want to be creating.
Mm-hmm.
So it was great for me because I like managing. I like sort of structuring a, you know, kind of a work environment. But I also love the content. So it was a chance for me to do all those things and allow Stephen to really focus on what he's best at. I mean, he's very involved in the running of the production company also. But, you know, he can tune it out and just go right for 3 days if
so
he wants.
I want to ask you a little bit about Freakonomics Radio, since that's the entry point for all of this, the vast empire that you built. Tell me what situation you were. This is a little disingenuous because I know the answer to this, but I'd like other people to hear. When you arrived, what was the situation that you faced with the show, with the distribution of the show, with the growth of the show? What were the challenges to?
Well, I think I wasn't clear because I actually didn't end up being the executive producer of Freakonomics Radio.
No.
So Freakonomics Radio was the only show that Stephen was host of at the time. It's co-produced by WNYC and Dubner Productions. And the way it's set up is that the entire staff is at WNYC. They're WNYC staff. The whole operation is run out of there, but Stephen works in his own office and sort of, you know, comes in to do interviews and writing the script.
Right.
So it's a little bit of an unusual setup. What Dubner Productions had was Dubner and an assistant.
A mysterious location. Yes.
Yeah. But he did want to, he had this idea, as you mentioned, of a show that he had just piloted as, were you working on the pilot?
Yeah.
You worked on the Tell Me Something I Don't Know pilot. So that happened
and
as
Joel Meyer, who produced it.
Yeah, who's at BEZ right now.
That's right.
Right, yeah. So that was a WNYC, a Freakonomics radio special. In the end, I think Stephen wanted it just to be its own show.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to figure out how are we going to make this happen. So the first thought was, let's find a production company that has a couple of producers that we can partner with. And we met with a lot of people and didn't either seem like a good fit or the company moved too slowly. And then we just one day we were like, why don't we just do it ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
I mean—
Yeah.
Why not? Let's just hire a couple people and do it.
And it was, I have a couple of questions I want to rewind the tape for in a minute, but it was conceived primarily as a podcast, not a radio show, right?
Correct.
Freakonomics Radio started as a podcast and a radio segment and grew then into a radio show.
Yeah.
You're thinking, is there the same trajectory or the development line as what you're looking at for Tell Me Something I Don't Know, too?
I think so. I mean— So Freakonomics Radio, as you said, has been a podcast for more than 7 years now, mm-hmm. I think. But it actually has really only been on the radio for a year and a half, 2 years maybe. And so I think, yes, definitely Tell Me Something I Don't Know was envisioned as a podcast. And then maybe eventually it'd be great to have on the radio. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's interesting that the industry is evolving that way where—
So you have one set of producers that you have to find to make a show like Freakonomics, which is heavily researched and requires a lot of tape that has to be carefully woven in and out of Stephen's narrative. What was behind the impulse to start a second very, I mean, even you may say the production team is small, but it's still very heavily produced mm-hmm. show. What was he trying to do differently with that show?
I think just the spontaneity, you know, I think the opportunity to be spontaneous. I mean, Stephen's a great conversationalist, and that does come across in the interviews he does for Freakonomics Radio, but we cut them. We don't get to sort of, you know, experience that kind of dinner party conversation.
Right. The moments with Levitt are kind of the moments that have those most often surface, I think, in that show.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then there was this— There was a lot of interest in the world in creating a game show. I mean, there's just an appetite for game shows. And I think in the beginning, we were very excited about making it a game show. We can talk about this, but it's evolved in that it's less game show-y.
Oh, we're going to talk about
it. Yeah.
Yes, you're not getting away with talking about that.
I know. So it was a combination of wanting to do sort of live, spontaneous, seat-of-your-pants kind of conversation and make a game show, since those were so appealing to people.
We're going to take a break while I do an ad, if you don't mind sitting through my 17 attempts to read the copy.
Okay.
Then we will come back and do more.
Sounds good.
Okay. Do you prefer clunky work boots or delicate fashion boots? Cheap boots that fall apart after a few wears, or $400 boots that'll get you through the winter months? Well, here's something you might not know. There is, ladies and gentlemen, another option. Thursday Boot Company is a three-year-old bootstrapped, that's their joke, they wrote it, but I'm going to leave it in. It's a startup that has been shaking up the industry by selling really high-quality boots direct to consumers at unbeatable prices. Thursday boots are made with that versatility in mind. Work, play, work, play, work, play. Durable enough to take a serious beating and sophisticated enough to clean up for a date. Plus, they are crafted using quality materials like the famous, I can't pronounce this, Chrome XL leather. I guess it's Chrome XL leather from the Horween Tannery in Chicago. You all know the Horween Tannery. We've all been there. I drive by it every time I go through the loop. Yep, the Horween Tannery in Chicago. It's in the same North American manufacturing facility as the heritage brands that you, your parents, and your grandparents probably wore if they had shoes, which mine didn't because they were from Ireland and they were starving. With prices starting at $149 plus free shipping and returns, Thursday boots are hands down. I don't know whether that hands reference is right for this copy, but I know what they mean. Hands down, the best buy this season. And with their clean, timeless design and durability, they'll keep you standing confident for years to come. Head on over to ThursdayBoots.com and use the code, pay attention, free ship number 2 day. So that's FREESHIP number 2 DAY to have a pair on your doorstep by this Thursday. I don't know when you're listening to this, but by this Thursday. So Stitcher Premium is entering the musical podcast space with a new 3-part series, Stolen Idea. It's written by Matt Besser and Bobby Matthews. Matt Besser of Improv for Humans fame. You should know his name. Stolen Idea is a comedy punk rock musical that covers the theft of intellectual property in both the music and comedy worlds. The story follows a stand-up comedian and a rock musician who are both approaching 40. Well, that's in my rearview mirror, and are fearful that their time to make it is running out. Boys, you have no idea. If you only are approaching 40, you really have no idea. One has his idea stolen, the other steals an idea. Produced and mixed by Earwolf's lead sound engineer, Brett Morris, the 17-song soundtrack features performances by Scott Aukerman, Paul Rust, James Adomian, John Gemberling, Virginia Matthews, Harris Whittles, Mike Cassidy, Mike Still, and Danielle Schneider. It's a who's who of Earwolf, really. The best and the brightest are all gathered together under this one show, Stolen Idea. So listen to Stolen Idea on Stitcher Premium and get 1 month of Stitcher Premium free when you go to stitcherpremium.com/stolen and enter the promo code WOLFDEN. That's stitcherpremium.com/stolen, offer code WOLFDEN. Okay, we're back. Allison, we were talking about Freakonomics and the genesis of Tell Me Something I Don't Know. Does Stephen have a favorite child?
Oh, of those two shows?
Not of his actual children, but of those two shows.
I would never say that.
I'm sure that's all his real children.
That's a good question. I would tend to say Freakonomics Radio, except when he's in the moment with Tell Me Something I Don't Know, he is having a total blast.
Yeah.
So I think it, you know, like with real children, it some days one's your favorite and some days the other one's your
favorite.
Listen
up, Hockenberry kids.
Yeah. I got five of them, so they rotate. They don't get as much love.
That's good. You spread it out a little bit that way. No one gets too much.
Yeah.
Well, and tell me how do you envision your work as the chief of staff, the executive producer? How do you manage all those things? And are there things that you do as a producer? Because really, no matter what your title is, in the end, this is the way I feel, I'm still a producer.
Right.
That's what I do all day.
Yeah.
How do you manage so many things simultaneously with a relatively, and I should ask, how many people help you do it?
Oh, okay. First of all, how I manage them is with a certain amount of fear that I've got to drop the ball, which is a good motivator. So there are three people who put together Tell Me Something I Don't Know, plus me and Stephen. And we have a technical director who comes on board just when we need them. And then Freakonomics Radio has 4 staff members right now, producers and technical people, and is going to get a fifth.
So that's great. But still relatively small.
Yeah. So anywhere between eight and 10 people that I'm managing at any one time.
And both of them are weekly and seasonal at this point?
Freakonomics Radio is weekly. Weekly, just period,
right.
Not seasonal, although we do run a couple of repeats a year, but not many. And Tell Me Something I Don't Know is weekly for a 10-week season, and then we usually take a break of a few weeks and come back with another 10 weeks. So it's we've taped 30 this year. This year we will have 30 episodes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's quite an accomplishment.
Yeah. I'm crazy.
So you and I have talked off mic before, earlier this year, in fact, because, of course, Tell Me Something I Don't Know is one of our Stitcher shows, and we're interested in helping you and Stephen grow the show. How has the show evolved since it launched? I mean, I was there at show one, but I haven't been able to ride along for all the things you've done to change it and bring more people to it, really, and maybe more fun for Stephen and for you. If you can chart out where it started, what was the middle period, and where are you now?
Sure. So this will go back to my mentioning those sort of quick iterations of the tech world or, you know, web media world. So we did that with Tell Me Something I Don't Know this year. So the show began actually as a partnership with the New York Times. We did basically our pilot season was with the New York Times. It was good timing for them and for us. We really wanted to launch the show. They were just launching a new podcast division. They didn't even have somebody running that division yet, but they knew they wanted to very quickly get something out there. And so this was great because it had a brand, Stephen, already. It was sort of ready-made. We already had a budget. We already knew how we were going to execute it. So we partnered with them for the first six.
And he had written for the Times. So their readership and their audience knew who he was.
Exactly. Really. Yeah. So that was, that was great. I mean, in the end, the Times wanted to go in a different direction with their podcast, and they've been very successful with the Daily. And I think that was brilliant of them. I'm actually a little surprised it took them so long to figure out that's what they needed to do to make a great New York Times branded podcast.
Well, it goes back to they're so big and getting big things to change is not easy to do.
We discovered that also when we were working with them. Yeah. It's just a slow, very slow moving bureaucracy.
Yeah. And I don't think anybody in any organization like that ever wishes they were like that.
Right.
It's just that you have so many more people that have a tiny slice of you that you have to go back and get.
Exactly. It's very frustrating from my our perspective, I should say, from Dubner Productions, because we're so small and so nimble, it can be frustrating to work with a big organization like that. So we're wondering, why is it taking 3 weeks to make a decision that we would make sitting around the office? But in any event, it was a very good partnership, and it ended, very peacefully.
Yeah.
And then we partnered with you guys, and that partnership is really you guys support us in obviously ad sales and marketing and ideas, and we do the production, and it's been a great partnership
because
we feel we're very good at production, and you guys are good. Well, you guys are good at production too. But
thank you.
And so what we then did was we rented a theater. And we just started producing our game show, which in the beginning was very ambitious. We had three celebrity panelists every show.
I remember.
And a fact checker and a spinning wheel of fortune. Well, we called it the wheel of maximum danger. There were many rounds of this game show. It was actually fairly complex.
And you pre-interviewed at least some of the contestants at that point, too, right?
Yeah.
Very extensively at one stage, I remember.
Yeah, we still do. So we used to have seven contestants. Now we've very wisely cut it down to five, which makes for a better length podcast and is a lot less work for us. So yes, we had a survey that we sent out to cull ideas for contestants, and we vet them all. I mean, we vet them all because... So this is a part of the evolution of the show. Originally, we thought, well, we'll just pull people out of the audience and they'll tell us fascinating things. Well, there are interesting people in the world.
We did that in episode zero, the pilot, and it was really inconsistent.
Yeah, exactly.
It could be entertaining. You couldn't predict it.
Exactly. And that you need some predictability. You just really do. So it was very, very labor intensive. It still is, but it was much more so then because we were, first of all, trying to book three celebrities, different kinds of voices, but who sort of would mesh together. They all had to be in the same city, available on the same day, a good talker, willing to do it. I mean,
you set yourself up for a nervous breakdown, basically.
Well, poor Harry Huggins, who is our staff member who does the bookings, it just was a big challenge for him.
He was the kid I saw crying in the office last week.
Quite possibly.
Okay.
So, I mean, he did an amazing job, and we got fantastic bookings. It was hard to produce. I mean, it was hard to pre-produce. But then on stage, what we discovered was Stephen had to end up being kind of like the ringleader, managing all these different voices and trying to make sure everybody was getting a say, and people who were seeming quiet were drawn into the conversation. And in the end, he didn't get to spend very much time asking questions of the contestant, who is ostensibly the sort of star of the show, who comes up and tells us something fascinating.
I noticed that when I saw one last year sometime, that it didn't have as much Stephen time as I kind of wanted.
Yeah, we felt that too. We tried the three celebrity panelist thing and all the whiz bang game show stuff for probably 10 to 15 episodes. And we traveled it. We did that format in a couple of cities. And then we just were flattened by it. Yeah. It was a lot. And then not only the panelists were, celebrity panelists were hard to book, but then, as I said, we were trying to book seven people per show who had something fascinating to say, who fit a particular theme, who were in a city, who could be there on the right night. It was just, you'd have to, for each one person we got to be at the live show and tell us something we didn't know, you'd have to talk to 10.
So is this then a crisis, or was it, well, we have a break of 3 weeks built in, we have time to reinvent this a little bit? Or what was the process for, because this is something else that people have to wrestle with. My show is plateaued, or it's not doing what I think it should, or I'm finding it impossible to do. What was your process for managing that change and getting it to a different place?
Well, I mean, it's very simple. As I said, we're very nimble. We sat around the office, we talked about what was and wasn't working, and then we just said, okay, next show, let's change it. I mean, it was really that simple. The change wasn't immediate. So now the show, if you listen to it, has a single co-host, not a panel of three celebrities. But and a lot of the game show element is missing, although we still crown a winner. Mm-hmm. But we tried a lot of different things before we got to that point. So one problem we had was we felt like the celebrity panelists weren't really giving us their best. They weren't talking as much as we wanted. So we tried, you know, little gimmicks and shticks and stuff to get them to be drawn out some more, and that didn't really work. So we
often
abandoned
those feel
that.
Phony. I think you can always feel like setup has happened.
Yeah, I think that's right. So that didn't work, and then I can't remember. I would say we probably did five different versions of format.
Wow.
Until we landed on what we are now, which we actually really feel very comfortable with. So we just did six shows at Joe's Pub. We just taped them last weekend, and they'll be coming out over, you know, in October and November. And we felt really, really good about them. It's Steven, a single co-host. Almost all of our co-hosts were very good.
Who are some of the co-hosts, just so people can get a preview of who's coming?
John McWhorter, who is fantastic, a Columbia University linguist and an author who every single sentence that comes out of his mouth is a gem.
Yeah.
And he's a lovely person. He's just quick. He's got great questions. He's exactly what you'd want. He's inquisitive and a great talker, but he's not a journalist. And he has expertise, you know, about language that just kind of can apply to many, many things. So that was wonderful. We had Alex Wagner, who's the CBS This Morning Sunday anchor.
Oh, yeah.
Very quick, very fun. She was terrific. And then another great co-host is Angela Duckworth. She wrote the book Grit. She's also a MacArthur fellow.
Yeah.
Was a MacArthur genius. She's a professor at UPenn. She's also lovely and very quick-witted and just asks great, great questions. So those were some of our mm-hmm. co-hosts. And we'd like to have a roster of, you know, maybe 6 to 8 co-hosts that we just go to time and time again, instead of having to book someone new every time.
Well, you can build loyalty with the audience for these people too,
exactly.
Right? They can look forward to the Duckworth episodes or something, whoever it turns out to be.
I think there's a lot of value in that. I mean, it's fun to mix it up a lot, but I think if you want a particular level of quality, it's just better to find those people that you know you can count on.
So in terms of the Dubner Productions empire, is there more growth? Are you thinking, are there more shows coming? Do you think about, and maybe it seems impossible that Stephen could do a third show, but it doesn't seem impossible to me, knowing him a little bit, that he would think about doing a third show or a fifth show.
Yeah, first of all, I cannot take any credit whatsoever for the Dubner Empire. I mean, it's all Stephen. But he's a person with a lot of ideas. And there is another idea for a show that we've been toying with doing, and we've actually created a budget and developed it. And it's just a question of bandwidth. And I think this year has been all about launching Tell Me Something I Don't Know and making that as good as we can make it. So I would say I don't know the answer to that yet. Are there enough ideas to do some other podcasts? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. How to execute it, and if we want to, that's another question. But that's a question for next year, for sure.
Well, that leads me to a question I had for you, just as a listener, provided you have time to listen. What are you hearing in podcasting, trends or genres of shows that are emerging that you yourself are really interested in and would like to maybe have a piece of in the Dubner Empire someday?
Ah, that's a good question. Well, I have to say, maybe this is a boring answer, but the more journalistic podcasts are appealing to me. And not interview shows necessarily, but things that really sort of explore a topic in depth. I just like those. And I think they're, you know, I think the two people talking in a room, there's a lot of those. And I think they appeal to the niche audience that they're aimed at. And I think that's great. I'm just much more interested in sort of nonfiction narrative. Mm-hmm. And not so much document. I like listening to documentaries, but I like a voice to lead it along. Maybe that's just from my days in TV or something. You have someone holding your hand through something complex. I like that.
What do you think the audience is looking for? I'll just give you an example. We launched the show with LeVar Burton this year, and right. I think there are other examples that other podcasters have launched that it's really escapism from a lot of what's going on. You can immerse yourself in a story and really lose the idea that there's a terrible world happening outside your earbuds.
Yeah, that's a good point. It could be, although, you know, there are some very political shows that are very, very popular now too, but yes. I don't think we need too many more of those. Yeah, the escapism thing I like. I mean, I guess I could think of our shows, both of our shows, as sort of intellectual escapism, which mm-hmm. is very valuable. And, you know, it's a good way to kind of, what's the word when you're doing three things at once? Multitasking?
I couldn't think of it because I was talking to a microphone and holding this pen.
Yeah. I mean, I think people are looking for ways to, use their time wisely. I mean, I think we're all overwhelmed by, the sort of minutiae of everyday life. And so if you can, while you're exercising or while you're driving, have an experience that's transporting you, allowing you to escape, but also giving you some food for your brain. I mean, I would hope that's what people are looking for.
I hope so, too.
Yeah. But I know people also like listening to a show that's just people sitting around yucking it up,
too. You do need that. Sometimes you really need that.
Yeah, true.
Before you go, where can we find you yourself on social media? Or do you not maintain a presence?
Well, I do. I am on Twitter.
Okay.
Allie Hawk. Allie Hawk.
Okay.
I don't tweet all that much. I do tweet from the Freakonomics, though.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. I'm one of the tweeters.
How will we recognize your tweets?
Probably they're not as irreverent as they should be.
The self-criticism is really unyielding with you, I think. And I have one last question based on that. If you were going to tell someone who's starting their career as a producer one thing to do that would ensure that it goes well, what would that be? What's the one piece of advice you'd give them? Do, be, say, what?
Care about the listener, I would say. Hmm. Just really care. They're spending their time with you. Give them something that's valuable. Give them a reason to listen.
I'm afraid Lex and I have flagrantly violated that advice, but we try. Thank you very much for joining us, Allison.
My pleasure.
Yes,
thanks,
and say hello to Stephen.
I will.
Well, that's The Wolf Den. Thanks to Harry Nelson and Jared O'Connell. You can subscribe to the show at earwolf.com, on Stitcher or Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate the show on iTunes. It really matters to Lex. Just a reminder that this episode is brought to you by our friends at Thursday Boot Company, handcrafted with the highest quality materials and sold at honest prices, starting at just $149, including free shipping and returns. The best boots at the best value are only a click away. Head on over to thursdayboots.com and use the code FREESHIP2DAY. Let me spell that for you, FREESHIP, number two, DAY. That's two, like the number two, day, to have a pair on your doorstep by this or any Thursday, apparently.
Earwolf? More like fear wolf. Get ready to quake in your headphones because Earwolf's movie podcast are talking about horror movies the entire month of October. Listen to How Did This Get Made? The Canon and Cracked Movie Club dissect spine-tingling horror classics all month long. And watch out for special spooktacular episodes of Gilbert Gottfried's amazing colossal podcast, The Cracked Podcast, and Who Charted, or should I say, Boo Charted? Subscribe to all these shows and follow along on social media with the hashtag FearWolf. And beware of podcasts that go bump in the night!
This has been an Earwolf production. Executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.
Want to hear Earwolf pilots before anybody else? We made a podcast feed just for you. Earwolf Presents is full of great stuff, like preview episodes for upcoming shows, peeks behind the paywall, and pilots for podcasts that haven't even been made yet. It's like getting to listen in behind the scenes here at Earwolf. Starting January 21st, Earwolf Presents will have a bunch of new pilots for you, like Edgar Montplaisir's The Wokest. Catch conversations between the wokest man in the world and comedians like Risa Lechea. Also, hear upcoming pilots The Florida Cast, Wow, You're Native American Too?, This Week in Sports, and Carl Alarm all throughout the month. Let us know what you think of them with hashtag Earwolf Presents. Subscribe to Earwolf Presents to hear more great episodes from around the network and behind the paywall, like an episode of Drew Tarver's Strictly Business with Derek Contrera, or Act One of Matt Besser's punk musical, Stolen Idea. Just search for Earwolf Presents in your podcast app and subscribe so you don't miss an update.